Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schrockerbrod here with Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Erson Religioso. How's everyone doing tonight?
Doing good, Gene.
I'm doing well, Gene.
Excellent. So before I introduce our guest of today, I'm going to do a quick shout out to Brooke McIntosh for participating in the last podcast called 7 Days Until. Brooke was a little crazy and brave enough to record her 7 days leading up to her board exam. And so if you haven't listened to that, that was a lot of fun to kind of put together and talk through with her. I think it was to me, it was one of the most fun to edit and to do. So Brooke, thanks for participating in that. And leading into the other spectrum of therapist, from a DPT student trying to become a professional to a physical therapist working with professional athletes. And joining us today is Dr. Mike Tankovich. And Mike is a physical therapist for a little team you might know of if you watch, what's that league called where they have the ball that's made out of, what is it, Joe? It's some kind of...
That deflatable ball?
Football. Is it football? I'm pretty sure it's some kind of animal skin.
Yeah.
Joe, you would know. I think you played that sports.
I believe pig, Gene.
Oh, it's a pig skin. That's right. A football. Yes. And the team is the Seattle Seahawks.
I heard of them.
Have you heard of them?
Yeah. They're
pretty terrible, aren't they? As far as I know. Pretty terrible team. So joining us, Mike. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
You're still there?
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate the opportunity.
So you, obviously, the whole lead up to that is that you are a physical therapist for a professional team, being a football team. So what was your journey to that? Is that something that you always wanted to do? Was it just an opportunity that came up that you couldn't pass down? How did you get to that position?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I actually started college as a business major, and most people that know me now probably wouldn't believe that because this is definitely a passion of mine. But I actually, at some point during that, went through a phase where I was just really unhappy with I did well in accounting and economics, but I took a legal studies class, and that was kind of the turning point where I was like, okay, look, I don't want to do this anymore. And I had always been into, playing sports, fitness, training for sports, had incurred some injuries because of that and that I had to come back from, and really enjoyed that process and really enjoyed the process of training and trying to get better at something. And I think some of the people around me really saw that, and even, trying to help other people around me improve certain areas, whether it's training or getting ready for sports in high school and coming back from injury. And there was a point in time where it was almost like an intervention with my wife, who was girlfriend at the time, and her mom, who is a physical therapist, and I used to fill in at the clinic as a PT aide when they needed someone, and basically said, why are you doing this business? You don't really seem interested in it. Have you ever thought about, taking a different path and going to PT school? And
wow, so you got a talking to from your wife and your mother-in-law.
Yeah. And
that's,
it was probably
intense.
And, it sank in really quick, and I literally that Monday, I think it was probably on a Saturday, that Monday I went into my counselor's office and I changed my major to pre-physical therapy. And then I actually, as I was working at the clinic, another one of the PTs that was working there recommended athletic training as an undergrad route and said that that would be, you know, a great backing for you know, later on going to PT school and kind of learning some stuff ahead of time. And I looked, and Georgia has, University of Georgia has a very good athletic training program. So that was something that as soon as I could, I enrolled in that. Had to obviously take a bunch of extra science prerequisites and started working for that. And that was really the big change, was seeing what it was like at a high level setting like that, a D1 school, you know, really good athletes, and being around that was you know, definitely a fun experience. But I did know in the back of my head that I did want to go to PT school. I wasn't exactly sure exactly what setting I wanted to work in. You know, orthopedic and sports was definitely the way I wanted to lean, but I wasn't positive of exactly where I wanted to work. And when I started PT school, I didn't really have the intention of working with a in team sports anymore, and let alone a professional sports. But part of my decision to go to the PT school I did was George Davies, which was a name that, as I was in athletic training, his name kept coming up in different articles that we had to read, or, you know, protocols, post-op protocols, and rehabilitation. And when I found out he was actually teaching at one of the schools in Savannah, Georgia, the Armstrong Atlantic State, it made a pretty easy decision that if I got into Armstrong, that's where I wanted to go, and I wanted to be able to work under him and study under him.
Did you?
And I did, and that was an incredible experience. And I actually got to work with him as his graduate assistant, which really just it pushed me further than I would have ever gotten to on my own, and changed my thought process for the better. I kind of joke with people now whenever I write a rehab, I kind of think, you know, they used to have those old bracelets in the, I think it was probably 90s. It said, "What would Jesus do?" You know, to try and make decisions. So when I write rehabs now and I'm taking someone through rehab, is what would George do? You know, would he be happy with what I'm doing right now? Would he approve of this?
Can you think of any examples of how he was different in his mindset that when you started talking with him and training with him, you're like, okay, this is not the typical rehab that I was thinking about?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is attention to detail. I think we, as clinicians, you know, we get caught up in, especially when you're busy, you get caught up and you kind of start going through the motions again. Rehabs start to, you know, you focus in on your certain points and it's like, okay, I really need to do this particular movement. This is important. But then you miss some of the other details. Well, you know, what kind of volume and loading do I need for this? And if I do this kind of loading and volume, you know, what should my rest period, rest interval look like? And, you know, how many days are they going to require to recover from this? And, you know, what exactly am I trying to accomplish with, you know, every single exercise, every single set, every single rep of what I'm taking an athlete through to try and return them to competition? And I think that's just something that, you know, George has, he's always had these questions. And when he's not satisfied with the answer, he's going to go look for it. He's you know, reads more research than anyone I've ever met. He's, I think he has a subscription to 20 different journals and says that he reads every article and every one every month.
Well, he must be the most frustrated person on that campus then.
Yes, but that's where he's gone on from that, is that when he can't find the answer, he's willing to play around with things. And once he thinks he comes up with something, he wants to actually research this. Let's put this into a setting and see if this works or it doesn't work. And he's got a really good ability to look at things objectively. And even if he believes in it, if he can't, if it's not working, then he's going to try and move on and find something else that does. So I think for me, especially as a, when I was, you know, going through school, of really having that very detailed approach to looking at things, asking the right questions, and trying to find answers. And when you couldn't find answers, you know, move on, but make sure that you're always learning as you go. And that can be just, you know, every single patient is an N of one. Make sure that you're constantly assessing, reassessing, you know, have a very solid clinical audit process so that you know you're headed in the right direction and don't give up on that.
So it sounds like you had a good foundation put upon you by somebody that's not satisfied with just doing something for the sake of doing it. And I think that's super important, especially for all our DPT students listening. Shout out, hashtag DPT student. That, you know, the mentorship part is important, but not any mentor is good. You know, it's the mentor himself or herself has to be a good clinician, a good teacher, and wanting to push forward instead of just regurgitating information. It sounds like that's what you really had.
Absolutely. And there's even more than George. And I'd say all of the faculty at Armstrong was great. It was a very evidence-based program, but understood the limitations of that. And this is something I think is important for, and whenever I talk to people who are interested in going to PT school or starting PT school, and they ask for recommendations, and I said this was something else. I drove our clinical coordinator nuts, because when I went on a clinical, I didn't say, oh, I want to stay in town and I want to do outpatient, or I want to go to this city and do inpatient here. I searched and I found clinicians either through just talking to people or attending. George would host a journal club, so PTs could get continuing education and we could, you know, talk about relevant research for certain case studies or patient populations. But I had the opportunity to meet clinicians that were really, really good at what they did. And when I found those, I said, okay, well, I want to work with this person. So another clinician I was fortunate to work with really early on, one of my, I guess, second clinical experience when I was in PT school was Ian Young, who he's now a instructor with James Dunning through his courses. And at the time, he had taken most of the courses there along with gone through a lot of MDT and was very similar in the fact that he had these questions. He constantly wanted to learn, and it was a great experience because he the way he ran his clinic was that he was doing a couple different clinical studies at the time. So he was constantly screening patients to see if he could get them into the study, which was interesting in and of itself to see how, you know, a clinician that's working your you know, normal, you know, 40-hour work week in a PT clinic is also conducting clinical research for publication. But he treated every patient like that. So, you know, using the proper standardized questionnaires, whether it's the, you know, NDI, you know, he wanted to have that so that he could essentially at any point in time get authorization and do a case study on any of the patients that he had seen, because he had done such a thorough job of tracking them and assessing them. So that was really cool to see that in a clinic, because I also did, you know, go to a clinic where it wasn't quite the same. And I was like, well, you know, why don't we do more of this? We should, you know, why don't we really assess and see if our outcomes are changing over time or if we're staying the same? You know, the way I see it is as we learn more, as we do more, we take more courses, we should improve as clinicians. At least that's my hope for me. I don't want to be doing the same thing in 5 years and getting the same outcomes. I hope that I'm getting better ones.
That's a right general outcome, I think, for most people, I'd hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's having that very reflective practice, though. And I think, you know, when we get busy, it's easy to lose that. But, you know, remember what you did, reflect on what you did, and then how you can improve each time. And I think sometimes everyone wants it, and we start to lose it, though.
It's certainly easy to fall into a rut or, you know, just your average everyday standard treatment and not fully be aware or be assessing your result. And I think that you make a good point there when you say you got to constantly be reassessing and not only the patient, but you know, your treatment and plan of care.
Absolutely.
Yeah, your mindset, like you said, it's the routine, the danger of the routine and the comfort zone that I did this with this patient, they have similar symptoms, then, okay, let me do this again. And as soon as the patient gets better, you're like, okay, it worked, versus really processing how much better they got and can you do better? You know, is there better, and to push yourself. So it's breaking away from that comfort zone, and and complacency. Avoid complacency and comfort. Always push yourself. So as you, sounds like you had, again, a really good initial foundation and experiences. So how did you, what was that transition from school to practice to professional sports?
Yeah, so wasn't quite as far off topic as you might think. So this leads me in. So I had George Davies as a mentor through PT school. And as I was getting to the end, he actually got an email from a former student and patient of his from a long time ago when he was full-time working at Wisconsin Lacrosse. And it was actually the former head athletic trainer of the Seattle Seahawks. He's now the director of player health and performance. And he was looking for a PT. They were trying to bring on a PT at the Seahawks. And he reached out to George to see if there's anyone he would recommend. And my name came up, surprisingly enough. I remember getting a call from George saying, hey, you know, I've got this this opportunity that I'd like to recommend you for. I just wanted to run it by you. And he said Seahawks. And I was like, well, I don't know anything about the Seahawks. I live in Georgia. And, you know,
So you were essentially what we were like in the beginning of this podcast.
Yes. Yeah. And you probably know even more than I did at the time, to be honest, because I was like a college football guy, you know, SEC, you know, NFL. I'll watch the Falcons every now and then, but I don't really care that much. And, yeah, so I didn't know much about it, but I was, you know, obviously I'm not going to pass up an opportunity like that. But at the time, you know, I'm thinking this is a long shot. Don't know if anything will come from this. And, you know, so I got in touch with him and I sent in my resume and, you know, heard back and they said, okay, well, you know, this is something we're going to be looking at in the future. We just wanted to get your name in there. So, you know, we'll get back to you. So didn't hear anything for a while. And I, was actually all set up to start working at a clinic. And
so was this while you were still in school?
Yes. So this was this was the very end of school. And I went away for my second clinical. I was actually in Park City, Utah. And I think it was maybe the day before I was planning to leave to head back to Georgia, I got a call from Sam Ramsden at the Seahawks saying that, you know, is this something I was still interested in and would I be able to fly out for an interview? And at this point in time, you know, we had, I had already set up, I had already, accepted another job and, you know, wasn't quite sure about this, but I was, but I was like, well, I can't pass this up. You know, I've got to at least go out. So, I'm really glad I did. So I went out and met with the other assistant athletic trainers and met with Sam and, you know, I still wasn't sure about it, but as soon as I started talking to Sam, I was like, this is something I'd really like to be a part of. It was such a progressive approach, the way he was looking at, you know, the potential we had to affect the players and, really make a difference looking at performance aspects and not, you know, your typical, you know, we're just going to rehab this guy and try and get him back to the field. It's really, what is everything we can do from, you know, looking at the whole person, you know, can we make athletes sleep better and eat better and recover more effectively so they're able to handle the training load better and reduce injuries. And it was a really cool conversation. I actually felt like the interview was more of just, you know, talking shop of what is the potential? Like how good could the performance therapy model be?
So it sounds like the interview sold you more than
In a sense it did. You know, I came off it. I was kind of on a high. I was like, man, I really hope I get this. I don't know what'll happen. And so it was still a little while before I actually heard back from them, and they offered me the job, and it was a no brainer. As soon as I got it, I took it. It was a tough conversation with the other job I accepted, because I also, you know, it was a great group of clinicians in a clinic chain in Savannah that was really, really good. And I would have been very happy working there, but
it couldn't
have been
that tough. I mean, Joe, yeah, if you just hired a new student, he goes, listen, I just got offered a job by the Ravens. Are you really going to give him a hard time?
Yeah, no, we're not really competing with that. And you know what, from an employer standpoint, you don't want somebody there that doesn't that that is thinking they passed up an opportunity that that they really wanted. I mean, you want it to be a good fit both ways, and so
yeah. Every time you ask them to do something, hey, did you do your notes? They'd be like, I bet the Seahawks wouldn't be bugging me to do my notes.
Right, Mike, I got a question for you. You talked about, you know, a lot about the sports performance aspect. So tell us, you know, what you learned in the interview and what you guys are doing and what the latest research basically says, because I'm very into that, about why athletes don't heal, or, you know, what research is showing about how to improve the performance. Because those of us who are maybe coming from only ortho backgrounds, you're typically just rehabbing a patient, getting them back to sport. Maybe you condition them, maybe you don't, but once they're kind of, you know, pain-free and back to function, you may not see them anymore, versus you often don't try to get them better at what they're doing. So tell us the differences and tell us what measures you're doing, or maybe even some things that you're doing to measure injury risk.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of a black hole, so I don't know where this is going to go to start with. But
I know that was a very broad question. I know.
Yeah, no, but it is a great question, and I think this will be good for the any of the PT students or even young clinicians that are still kind of trying to find their niche, where they want to be, and some of the differences. And I'll say for me, the first year was really, really tough, because I had gotten very comfortable in a clinic working with, I was extremely into the pain science and David Butler and Explain Pain. And I didn't go anywhere without my Explain Pain book. And I love drawing diagrams for patients. And I got really good working with your typical middle-aged female woman with neck pain, sometimes chronic, and helping them deal with that and get better, knowing that it was about recovering function, that, you know, if they've had chronic pain for 10 years and they've seen 10 different, you know, physicians and, alternative medicine, you may not entirely reduce their pain, because there's so many psychosocial factors that go into that, but there's always something you can do. And then I got into this setting with professional athletes, and the culture is so different. Obviously, I see a lot of the same things, but it's a lot of trauma. The way the athletes view injury varies tremendously. And a lot of the guys that have made it to this level have been fortunate to be relatively healthy through high school and college. So I work with a lot of guys that are, you know, 22 to 25 years old that had their first big injury, and that big injury, maybe something like a grade one hamstring strain, to an average clinician doesn't seem like that big of a deal, and most of them probably don't even get to utilize physical therapy, which is a shame, because it could be a huge difference for them. But you think about average time of, say a weekend warrior just playing in a softball tournament and gets a grade one hamstring strain. You know, he's probably going to know something happened. He's probably going to talk to some of his friends, and they're going to recommend, some basics to him of what to do. Some of them are probably good things to do. Some of them not so good. But, if it lingers on for a week or so and it feels like it's getting worse or it's not getting better, they may set up an appointment to try and see a physician who most of the time is going to be a general practitioner that doesn't really deal with this, because chances are they're not actually going to get into an orthopedic physician's office for something like that. And
that's a whole separate conversation in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they are lucky enough to get a referral to physical therapy, you're looking at, you know, best case scenario, maybe 2 weeks out from something like that. In our setting, it's almost a completely flip-flopped. So when I have, say, an athlete who's got a grade one hamstring, and hamstring strains are definitely an area of focus for me that I've spent a lot of time reading research and trying to really figure this one out. And reading research about hamstring injuries is frustrating in and of itself, because a lot of the answers come to, well, we don't really know. But by 2 weeks, if I don't have that athlete on the field competing, whether that's in a game and or practice setting, that's pretty bad. Ideally, I'm going to take, and this is where I say the biggest difference is between working in a clinic and the patient population you see versus working in athletics, is that most of the time, I'm going to have, hopefully, if everything goes well, a grade one hamstring strain running full speed upright by 5 days.
Now, how much pressure is on you if you don't? Because it is professional sports and it is a business. Do you feel like there's that pressure from other coaches or owners or fans to get that player out there?
There definitely is. I would say we're very fortunate. We have a great organization between our management, our GM, and our coaches, both positional and the head coach, where, you know, sometimes they do get very frustrated with this, but they believe in what we're doing. They trust us. And I would say when we can look at the stats of it, they ultimately, we don't want to put an athlete on the field when they're not ready, because I think the if you look in the literature, the average recurrence rate for a grade one hamstring strain is about 21 or 22%. That's high. That's almost a quarter, fifth of athletes that are going to restrain that hamstring. And when you have a restrain, even if it's still a grade one, that tends to be a longer recovery. So they, because of that, and this is something where I've made mistakes before, so you start to see trends and patterns. And the biggest thing is making sure athletes are ready to return to the field when you let them return to the field. And so there are certain things you feel pressure for. I think we've gotten our coaches, and for the most part, to understand really well about, you know, soft tissue, musculotendinous strain injuries. We have to be careful with those, because if they're not ready, they're at a higher risk for making that worse and missing more time. There are other injuries where sometimes you treat something a little bit differently in season, or, you know, in the playoffs than you would out of season. You know, I want to give them a little bit more time to train. But I think one of the big viewpoints that's different between how I looked at things in a clinic and in a professional setting is it's always about what the athlete can do. What is, I want them, it's kind of like, you know, Charlie Weingroff or Bill Knowles talks about that the training equals rehab and rehab equals training. It's always, I'm always training them at the highest level they can tolerate. Sometimes that doesn't look very intense or very high because I have to respect the healing times of a certain injury, but it's always the end goal in mind.
How much of a preventative piece do you put onto that? Obviously one of the best ways to treat an injury is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And we've seen, and we talked with Stefania Bell about this a little bit, is when she visits different sports or camps or things like that, she can see some of the stuff they're doing. And sometimes it's still very old school, you know, especially in baseball, sitting around stretching, versus I feel like the NFL is a little bit more progressive with their warm-ups and what the research shows in terms of dynamic warm-ups and those kinds of things. How much of that do you get to integrate, and how fast is that process? Because I feel like with sports, especially professional sports, there's such a superstition or routine that, you know, we can't change it too quickly because who knows what will happen.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I would say, compared to some other sports like rugby and European soccer, we're still a little bit behind, but we're definitely making strides. I think we're going in areas that are fairly novel for American football, but it's also tough because injuries are so multifactorial. So one of the things we do, you're looking at athlete from a movement screen perspective, and I think it's important to understand the good things that come from that, but also the limitations that it is, you know, we're one of the few populations where it actually has been shown to correlate with injury risk, but it's still not that simple because it doesn't give you an idea of how well an athlete can absorb load and disperse force, which they're going to incur when they're out on the field and doing that. So that's when you kind of need to dig a little deeper, and that's something we can do with jump tests that are fairly objective, whether it's using the OptiJump or another system, so that you get some objective data. Do they have a limb asymmetry from an old injury? And, you know, some of the newer findings, especially on ACL, where athletes will have deficits for far longer than we think, even though when they look very functional to the naked eye and can perform, you see deficits, and we've found similar things with guys you know, even after they've gone through half a season or an entire season of playing football following a major surgery, that there's still some deficits there. There's still things we can improve. So you have to look at the movement aspect and of performance and trying to help guys not necessarily just achieve a better score, but some of the areas that we've looked at that correlate a little bit better with injury is kind of when you break out some of the tests. And mostly the asymmetries and the FMS, but it's not enough because when they're out on the field, I think one of the bigger areas where we've made some strides to change is having very objective data of what a practice looks like by using a GPS system that also has heart rate monitoring and seeing, you know, before we had that, you didn't really have a good idea of how many times, defensive back will accelerate and decelerate. What speeds are they hitting during a practice? How frequently do they do that? You know, what's their, you know, their internal load via heart rate that causes in that athlete? And once you have a little bit of that, you have an idea of what a practice actually looks like. And then you can start to tease out some of that. And with our sports science department, they're starting to see certain trends. But we found that there's a lot of variance. We have some guys, you know, we have a one of our guys that he's got a background in high level athletics, track and field in college, and he can handle an incredible workload in practice. It's almost, you know, inhuman the amount of sprints that he can run in a practice, and he'll come in the next day and feel perfectly fine. And part of the way we measure that is by having them fill out wellness questionnaires on a daily basis. So we have an idea if a guy is a few standard deviations off of what they typically answer. And it doesn't necessarily change anything right away. It's really what we do with that. And that can just spark a conversation with the athlete like, hey, you know, saw your scores are a little low. What's going on? And it may be that, you know, they had an event the night before and they didn't get very good sleep and now they're tired and they didn't get to go through the normal recovery routine with, you know, their mobility stuff. So they're a little bit sore and their hips are tight.
How receptive are professional athletes to treatments and things that you suggest? I mean, I would think that a lot of them are fairly motivated, but I'm also sure I bet a lot of them are, you know, kind of have that alpha male perception of, I think this is what's best for me. Do you ever get into that situation of saying something to one of them and they say, well, I think this will be better?
Yeah, absolutely. And the same with anything else, the guys are all across the map. And I think that's one of the ways. So our Sam, our director of player health and performance, kind of breaks guys down into different tiers. So you have your tier one guys that are, they will listen to anything you suggest and do everything. And those are the guys that, you know, they get great sleep. They talk to the nutritionist and have a complete plan set out. They will do all of their FMS correctives on a daily basis. And then as they progress, we'll look for new things. They'll follow some of the recovery protocols that we have. It's very easy to deal with them because you know that they're going to take care of themselves. And sometimes it's almost pulling them back and, you know, hey, you don't need to do too much, you know, like give your body a chance to just adapt naturally every now and then, especially, you know, during the off season. I kind of want you to get sore a little bit now. And then you have your most of your team, which is in the middle. If you make wide-ranging suggestions to them via a team meeting or flyers, they may or may not listen to it. But when you can pick out one thing that would make a big difference for them, whether it's sleep, you know, if they report having trouble sleep and then we can give them, you know, a device to measure their sleep and then we find out that it actually is fairly poor, then we can work some specific strategies for that. And when it's individualized, when it's one-on-one and you're talking to that athlete, those guys in the middle ground tend to be a little bit more receptive of that. And that's where you can really make some changes when you find out that, and don't give them too much to focus on. Give them, you know, one area, whether it's, you know, between every Wednesday, Thursday practice, you know, I want you to get in the cold tub for 10 minutes and do this other thing because that's going to help you recover for the next day. So you're ready to go. And then you have your guys at the bottom who, you know, they really don't care. They're not terribly motivated aside from, you know, they kind of like playing football and they like making a lot of money. And those guys, every now and then, you, when it's one-on-one, you can get somewhere with them, and then sometimes you can't. And I think what I've learned from Sam is you have to know when to push and when to, you know, just kind of let things be. So that's been helpful.
So not to name any names or where a certain player might be on that spectrum, but is there a certain player on your team that you can motivate very well with Skittles? True or false?
I don't know if Gatorade would like me to answer this question, but yeah, there, it might be. I don't know if anyone knows him though. He's not really that big of a deal.
Not that big. Yeah, you're right. I read about him on, I don't know if you guys have heard about this magazine. It's called, they have a little website too and a TV station called ESPN. He just pops up once in a while. I don't know.
Might just be me. Is it Espen?
I think it's Espen. If you say it. Speaking of that, do you know some people actually name their babies Espen because of that? Side note.
Oh, that's so bad.
I know that's terrible. So I mean, it sounds very much like a patient, right? I mean, Joe, if you are in the clinic and you have a PIA patient, everyone has them, and it's just if you get them one on one and you understand how to talk to them, you should be able to figure it out and talk them down or shove some Skittles in their mouth. Worst comes to worst.
Yeah, I mean, you break them down. It sounds exactly like a patient. You have to know when to which patients you need to push and which patients you need to kind of rein back in. It follows that same philosophy. I like the tier kind of labeling system. I think that. You could apply that to your you have your patients that perform their home exercises, although not many, but you do have some, and listen to all your recommendations, and then you have the other ones that you really can't depend on them to do much of anything to help themselves. So at that point, you know, it makes your job a little bit harder, but definitely need to understand where that patient falls on the spectrum, because that's going to allow you to have a better chance of connecting with them.
I think it's important to find every patient's motivation, but some patients absolutely have zero motivation and they have, you know, they want the quick fix. And basically I always tell them, you know, I can give you a quick fix, but it's actually just going to be that quick. And unless you reinforce it, you know, I can't make you better. No one can really make you better. You have to actually make changes in your life. And, you know, I try with them for about two visits. My leash actually used to be 4 to 6 visits, but now it's only 2. And if someone's not listening to me after the second visit, I'm just like, look, you know, I'm not, yeah, I'm wasting your time. You're wasting my time. So that's where I am at in my career now. I don't see people who aren't compliant after 2.
Yeah. And you're also not seeing people that make hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars have to be in the training room to get trained. So how does
not that... yet. I am going to be soon.
True.
Not yet.
There you go. We'll save that announcement for later. Right. Mike, so how does that actually work? How does the system of professional sports and physical therapy or training work? Are athletes required to receive treatment at certain times or a certain amount of times? Do you have certain goals that you or them have to meet? I mean, what kind of structure is it there for them to make sure that they're getting the most out of you and the medical team to maximize their output on the team on the field?
Yeah. So again, it is it kind of is one of those points where, you know, I guess what Urson's talking about is that in a sense you fire the patient and move on. And that's something I'd seen in a clinic, or you have a patient who, and I've had this happen before where they come in a clinic and you can just tell right away that they're not buying what you're selling. And you know, they come in for their visit, they humor you, and then you don't ever see them again after that. And I say that's probably one of the tricky things, is because we've got guys for good, and we've also worked for an organization that's invested a lot in most of these players, so we don't really get to move on. So it really is trying to connect with the athlete and get them to do everything they need to. I would say overall, right now our team is very good about this. The guys that are there are pretty motivated, and I've you know, especially long-term rehab. I really enjoy taking guys through long-term rehabs when, because I get to see them far more than I would ever see them in a clinic and get to train them through the entire process. I've written up some workouts that guys have done that, it's pretty cool that they don't complain and they just do this, because it's hard. You know, it could be 3 hours from start to finish through all the mobility stuff and the warm up, and then actually going through the warm up and then or the workout and then the cool down. I mean, it can take a long time, but you know, it's so is a practice. Preparing for a practice is, and being ready for the demands of a practice, it takes a long time to develop to that level, especially if you've been, you know, gone through a period of unloading where you couldn't run on the field and you couldn't do the drills you needed to do at a high level. So I think it's pretty neat, but there are those guys that it's very difficult. Every now and then there is a system where if a guy is a repeat offender, that they may receive a fine from the team for not attending treatment. But I would say since I've been here, we've actually gotten a lot better at that. And we have very, this last season, guys were extremely compliant. You know, they came in, they got done what they needed to do. And there's certain athletes where you can go above and beyond, where it's, you know, hey, you know, we got this treatment done through the morning, and then you had to go to meetings. We did some more at lunch, but after practice and after you get out of your meetings, like, come back and let's get another, session in of some stuff that's going to help you progress more quickly. So, you know, it's the same as training an athlete. You get them, you kind of base it off how much they're going to give you, and then feed them that much. Sometimes you need to bring someone up a little bit and, hey, you know, we need to do a little bit more. And that's where I'll try and break it down and really explain why we're doing everything we're doing. And then some athletes, you know, it's like you write them up this really long workout and then they still want to do extra stuff afterwards. So, I think the biggest thing is connecting and when you need to, giving really good education of why you're doing everything you're doing. And if you can't explain it really well, then, and it's taking up time, it probably shouldn't be in your rehab. So at times I cut stuff out. I'm like, you know, you probably don't need to do that anymore.
That's a good quote. That should be the quote for the interview, actually.
Done.
I have a question, Mike. Do you guys use heart rate variability at all to measure readiness?
So we have in the past. We did have a system. We do currently still have a system that uses heart rate variability. One of the reasons why we're not using it currently a lot, and we will use it in specific cases, is because it's a measurement that can be fairly noisy. So if you ideally you wake up first thing in the morning, you know, go to the bathroom quickly, come back, put the strap on, and some of the, I guess the accuracy of the test is very dependent on, well, somewhat dependent on how long the tests are run. Some of the ones that are a little bit shorter, I don't know if I would put too much weight in that if it's not at least a couple minutes long. But you would measure the test resting, you know, laying down in the same position, whether you always do it supine or always do it seated or always do it standing, and then go about your day. The unfortunate part is if you don't have athletes that are going to be willing to do that first thing in the morning and keep up with it, it's a little tough. So we had tried doing it with athletes as soon as they got to the building, set up an appointment time where they'd come in and we would do the testing. And in some cases it worked really well, but you also had guys that, you know, they're sitting in traffic on their way to work and they'd already eaten breakfast, or sometimes they would eat breakfast before the test, sometimes they eat breakfast afterwards. If a guy had caffeine or some kind of coffee, you know, that would affect the reading. So I think it got a little bit noisy, and it was something that we couldn't put too much weight in. So now what we can use it for is if I'll talk to the sports science department, if I have a guy that's a long-term rehab who's getting towards the end stages where it essentially looks like training, we're getting them ready for competition level activity. We'll try and get those guys set up to use that a little bit as we're to guide training, but it's definitely something we've gotten a little bit away from, just until we find a more practical way to set it up.
Nice. I mean, that's, it sounds like it's a very unique and I think exciting place to be a clinician in a professional sports arena, but I also think it's something that probably not everybody is made out to tackle, pun fully intended. It's fun, it's challenging, but like you said, I mean, it's, I'm sure a lot of students listening, it's a dream to work for a professional team. But like you said, the work that you put in, the time that you put in, I'm sure you don't get a whole lot of time off. It's exhausting, but if you had to do it all over again, would you still stick with this or would you go to the clinic that you turned down?
Oh, I'd absolutely be here. And I think part of it is the guys I get to work with, and it's, you know, the management and Sam and our head athletic trainer, Donald, just setting up a group of staff. We all get along great. And, you know, sometimes those, the long days, you need someone to just, say something funny and make everyone laugh and it gets you through. So
I thought you were going to say you just need somebody to hug you.
No, not a whole lot of hugs.
No,
definitely not that setting. But
no,
yeah,
no,
I mean,
when you
can joke around with the people you work with, and then you also work with people that are very passionate. And I think one of the cool things I get to do is because we work together as a team. Whereas in a clinical setting, hopefully, you know, everyone in the clinic gets along. And I know some clinics are really good about bringing in continuing education or having weekly in services where someone will present and teach a new technique. You know, we get to do that all the time. Whether it's not just us, it's with us, our chiropractors, our sports science department, and really work together so that everyone gets better and we continue to grow. It's really neat, especially coming in as a young clinician. I don't think I would have developed as quickly in a clinical setting. And then also, you know, football is a cool sport to work if you like working with injuries because, you know, even if we eliminate a lot of these non-contact injuries, we're going to have plenty of contact injuries.
Well, you get to see the injuries too, right? I mean, it's not like you have to get too creative with their subjective. It's right there. I mean, there's no question of what it is.
And that's the neat thing I've told people. It's a pretty cool experience to, you know, it's always unfortunate when an athlete gets injured. And I remember as an athlete, you know, when you got a prognosis and the prognosis said 8 weeks and you're like, 8 weeks, like I have to go 8 weeks without training and competing, like that's miserable. But, you know, I think when you really connect with an athlete and you put together and you do everything in your power you can to help them succeed with that, and you've taken them from, you knew them prior to an injury, you saw the injury occur, you were, you know, out there on the field and evaluated the injury. You know, you took them through their pre-op protocol, and then they had a surgery if they needed a surgery, and then you're with them day one until, you know, they're back out on the field. It's a pretty cool, you know, continuum of care. And then even when they make it back out to field, it's not necessarily over because one of the things we found is that whenever they're in front of the coaches or it's a competition level activity, you know, we have pretty good objective data that even a motivated athlete that really pushes themselves in a rehab setting, work-wise, the intensity always goes up a little bit, especially the internal load, their heart rate response to activity will always go up in a practice compared to the same workout done in a rehab setting when the coaches aren't watching. So, you know, sometimes you're even after they've returned to the field, it's still an ongoing process of maintaining and continuing to get even stronger, even more powerful so that they can maintain their performance. And that's been a neat experience to take someone through the entire process. And then you get to see them out on the field and you know, especially they have a great game and it's exciting.
Yeah, I bet that's pretty cool to see. Let me ask you a couple questions before we get our final thoughts. One, are you on the sideline during the games?
Yep, every game.
Awesome. And two, I feel like there's a lot of when injuries happen or there's potential of an injury if the player is kind of not playing to their full potential. I feel like there's a lot of proactive or just prophylactic imaging done And I feel like there's a lot of elective surgeries performed, whether it's just perception based on that ESPN show that we were talking about reporting it, or is it a real thing? Because I feel like diagnostic imaging and surgeries are extremely prevalent in professional sports, where most times physical therapy or other rehab would suffice.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say we do far more imaging than I would ever recommend in the general population. And some of that, it comes, one, from the athletes wanting to know. And obviously we know pain is extremely complex, so you can't go solely based on pain and just start imaging everything, because that a lot of times is going to be, cause more problems than it does good. But anytime there's something going on, the player wants to know, the management wants to know, you want to have a good idea of, where they're at. We also have a lot of baseline imaging, because guys go through the combine process teams want to know what they're investing in. So there is imaging on everything, whether it's x-rays, MRIs from almost any injury they've had while they were in college. So you got a guy that's, this happens a lot, especially in Seattle around November, our weather starts to turn and we go from practicing outside in the grass to inside on the turf. And we'll have a lot of guys that will, they'll come in one day, they're feeling fine, but they have a knee effusion and they're not sure why. They don't really remember anything happening. And it's just the change of going from grass to turf with the same load and volume. And sometimes it's, if you aren't able to control that quickly, and quick is a different meaning in the NFL. We always say, it's got to be done yesterday, because you're trying to get them ready to practice and play every single week. We don't have the luxury of time. So if the conservative approach with no imaging doesn't work very quickly, and you can't resolve that fluid and make sure they're back to function and handling it fine, sometimes we will go ahead and image something. Just to get an idea, make sure nothing new's happened. Sometimes it's just a progression of a chondral injury they already had. And so we'll do that. Same thing with a soft tissue injury, whether it's a groin strain or a hamstring strain. Sometimes it does. I think the best prognosis for re-injury, I saw there's just a study that actually compared MRI to physical exam. And tenderness on palpation was actually a better predictor of reoccurrence rate than getting an MRI and still having a signal on an MRI. But nonetheless, your how aggressive you can be with an injury is going to change. You're treating the patient, not the imaging. But when you have a grade one, we need to start getting on this. Day one, day two, we're going to start moving again and get you going so that we're ready to go. Whereas if you have a grade two, that may change how you treat that injury from a standpoint of, maybe you do a PRP injection or a cortisone injection for that injury. And obviously that's the physician's decision to make.
It seems like it's just a part of the system versus most times you can distinguish between a grade one, a grade two, or a grade three tear as a clinician. But I feel like because of the routine and the protocols that you have to follow, you're kind of, like you said, you don't have the luxury of time or waiting or seeing how it goes. And that's their protocol. That's the standard of care for them. And whether right or not, I have a feeling that'd be a hard thing to change, which I wouldn't be surprised if it does eventually, but not anytime soon.
Yeah. Yes and no. I've also seen, we've had guys with a grade three hamstring rupture. And if you go solely based on their exam, you would think they would have a grade one. Like they have full strength, full range of motion. They just can't run. And some of that I think is because these guys are not typical human beings. But I've actually seen multiple cases of that where we got the imaging and sure enough, they have avulsed one of their hamstring muscles and it's retracted, yet functionally it's very difficult to tell just because of how strong and powerful they are. So it is tough. As far as surgeries go, I definitely think there's ones, and I think the hip arthroscopies are going to be a big topic, similar to how you know, shoulder was all through the 90s and early 2000s about all of these unnecessary labrum tears, and you find all of these abnormalities and asymptomatic subjects. But I think part of the problem is because you really don't get an opportunity to reduce training load in season. Some of these guys develop so much soreness from that, and it's tough to get them to recover from that. Had they been in a conservative thing where they didn't have to play football, yeah, you probably could have treated them and got them entirely symptom free in everyday life, and even, you know, to a moderate level of athletics where they, you know, they could compete on weekends and practice a couple times in the week and they'd be fine. But playing and having to go through the amount of training load they have to do to play at this level, sometimes it's almost faster for someone to recover to go through that. And as much as I hate to say that, because I'm someone that I'm always, you know, anti-surgery if possible, sometimes it's the player's best bet.
Well, with that statement, you've been voted off the physical therapy island, and it was nice knowing you. Thanks for participating, and this podcast will never be aired. that makes sense. It definitely, you kind of do what you have to do, and the athlete has to do what's best for them overall, and to make that, you know, to earn the paycheck that they're getting. So with that, I mean, that was an awesome amount of information. I think between you, Sue Falsoni, and Stefania Bell, we covered a ton of information in professional sports and sports in general. Joe, any final thoughts, closing thoughts?
Yeah, man, I didn't even get to ask about concussions, Mike. What are you guys doing? One of our specialties is vestibular rehab. So what are you guys doing on the concussion aspect?
Yeah, we're really lucky because we have Dr. Stan Herring is one of our team physicians who's, you know, he's at the you know, the big meetings they have in Zurich and leading a lot of the concussion research. But yeah, it's definitely more progressive now. I think after that, I think it was 2012 when they had the last International Concussion Congress in Zurich. And what came out of that was a lot of actually getting them to very low level early activity, even if symptoms haven't cleared after a few days, because sometimes when they have that, getting them better does involve that. But yeah, definitely one of the big things to address that we see with concussion is doing a good assessment on the cervical spine, making sure you don't find anything there and treating that. But yeah, getting guys moving a little bit as soon as they can, or as soon as symptoms clear, not in a practice setting by any means, but working on some balance aspects, working on some light mobility, as many things as they can, definitely seems to help. But we're very conservative with working them back in, and they always have to complete a graded exercise program before they're going to be released back to activity. And you know, now with the hot topic it is in the NFL, they have to see so many different physicians to get cleared, including, you know, independent neurologist and whatnot. So it's a fairly thorough process by the time you're back on the field after a concussion.
Yeah, lawsuits tend to do that.
Yeah. But I, you know what? I think it's a good thing. I think,
definitely.
I think absolutely. It frustrates the coaches, and there's sometimes in the game, you know, you wish you had a guy back, but if they're not ready, they're not ready. And that's one of the things I like to talk to guys about and remind them, you know, when you're 40, 50 years old, you want to be able to play with your kids and your grandchildren. You know, don't forget about that.
And remember your NFL career.
Yes. Yeah. Remember anything.
I played football. What about you, Urs? Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that was just a plethora of information, and it kind of gets me prepared for some things I might be working on in the near future. So I really appreciate it. But yeah, you know, in terms of being a sports PT, I mean, everything you talked about was basically nothing you learn about in school or in most con ed courses. You know, I mean, you just had to go in there. I can imagine the first year was pretty tough, considering you even came out of PT school with this job. I mean, that's amazing, and kudos to you and obviously your mentors and your connections. So that's amazing. I mean, everything you learned this far is great. So I don't know, to be a great sports PT, you got to be a team player, right?
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear what's in the works for you, Arson.
Do you want to say it now, or do you want to save it for a different episode or something?
Oh no, I can say it because I've talked about it in the blog a little bit. Basically, I have a blog follower in Houston who's a massage therapist, and he, you know, started treating a decent amount of track athletes and Olympic hopefuls. And the one thing that he noticed is that, and a couple pro athletes as well. The one thing he noticed that even at that level, that a good majority of them were getting very, very poor old school care. And he really felt, and some of them even lost sponsorships just because of a minor injury, like a grade one hamstring strain, you know, something that should be taken care of, but they're basically just getting ice and stim and nothing preventative. And their coaches might be great, and they may not have great rehab, or they might have great rehab, but the coaches might not be great. So, and I went down there once as a pilot to treat some of these athletes who had chronic injuries, and several of them after just two sessions were back to throwing javelin or, you know, back to having PRs again just after a couple of sessions. And it was just from very, very simple stuff that I considered simple and basic. So we just identified this market down there that of very, very high-level athletes that just require better care. And, you know, that's what we'll be doing. And I don't think I'm allowed to say the name of the practice yet, but I'm kind of bringing in different PTs. The model is that I'll be there maybe once every 1 to 3 weeks. Then Chris Johnson, my buddy from Seattle, is also going to be part of my A team, and he's going to be there once every 1 to 2 weeks. And we'll probably have a full-time PT there who is neither Chris nor I to kind of head up things. And then the massage therapist, who's also heavily into nutrition and training, he's going to be kind of doing the day-to-day stuff and the recovery portion and work on your nutrition and your sleep and all of that. And it's also all catered toward kind of like oil money and yacht club that he's seeing. So, you know, there's no shortage of that down there.
PT on a yacht.
Yes.
Balanced training done.
Yeah. People who just want to pay me to, you know, fly in once a month just to see someone who they haven't seen before. So I'm excited for that. And other athletes, I probably can't say who may be signing up. So
very mysterious of you.
Yeah, because I don't know yet. But he can't say. He's on their NDA until we officially either sign them or they announce us as their part of their recovery.
There you go. So Urson's got a cool gig going on, and Mike, thanks a lot, obviously, for joining us. I mean, it was like
Urson Mike said, actually made me more nervous to do it rather than excited.
Good.
You'll be fine. I'll try and send you some stuff. But if you get the opportunity,
I want really some of the research you're talking about. Actually, the palpation one. You know, anything on hamstring strength, because the majority of the people I'll be treating are U.S. Track and field and Olympic hopefuls.
Well, if anybody wants anything that Mike talked about, Mike, where can people reach out to you? Twitter, email, anything?
You know, yeah, Facebook is really the best. I have a Twitter account. I honestly don't even remember what the name is. I'm not the best with social media right now, but Facebook, just Michael Tankovich. So
there you go. Get Michael.
If you don't seem too creepy, I'll friend you.
Well, that's
yeah. My rule is that you need to have at least I need to have two or three mutual friends.
That's a good start.
So the creepers are going to stalk your friends to become friends with your friends and then come to you. Way to go and get your friends involved.
Yeah. Urson, what I would recommend to you definitely though, if you get the time, spend as much time with the coaches on the track and just learning their warm up, learning the process. Cause that's what been one of the coolest things I've learned. One of our chiropractors, Jerry Ramajita, actually got to work with Dan Paff for UK athletics in the last Olympic cycle. And a lot of what he brought back is very neat stuff, how you really integrate rehab right back into their program, you know, as soon as possible. So that I think you're going to love that experience.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do want to spend time with the coaches. I want to spend more than 2 days there, basically.
Yeah.
We'll try to keep track of Urson's progress with this new endeavor and let you guys know how that's going, because that sounds like a really cool project. If you have any questions for Mike or for any of us from this podcast, you could always reach out at Therapy Insiders on Twitter, therapyinsiders@gmail.com. Again, you know, it's been awesome seeing all the emails and the conversations on Twitter started from the podcast. And going with the sports theme, if you listen to the Sue Falsoni podcast, which a lot of you did, that was one of our more popular podcasts. Sue created a special Therapy Insiders bonus pack for her shoulder DVD. So if you want to get that shoulder DVD, which Urson got a copy of, did you post a review yet?
It's only an hour long, but as you can imagine, I haven't had a time to review it yet. Actually, I'm going to watch it on a plane to the Philippines in a couple weeks.
So Urson will post a review, but I've seen some snippets and it looks pretty cool. So if you want special bonus footage, email me at therapyinsiders@gmail.com and I'll send you a special link to get this Therapy Insiders bonus footage for a shoulder DVD. It's pretty cool stuff. So Mike, again, thanks for joining us. We'll keep track of the Seattle Seahawks and we'll send you some Skittles.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mike.